from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In Crimea, it's been boots on the ground. Not battle ranks, but Russian. And Crimea is annexed. From Europe and the U.S., it's been sanctions. Modest sanctions so far. Talk of big sanctions and big ideas. Democracy and freedom. Does the West still have the unity to confront Russia if Russia rolls on? Is confrontation required here? This hour on Point, the U.S., Europe, and Russia now, and where this new standoff goes. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see unfolding here? What should the message, the action be from the West? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Brussels is Major Garrett, Chief White House Correspondent for CBS News. He is traveling with President Obama today in Brussels. Major, welcome. What's the latest we're hearing from the President of the United States there?
Well, Tom, great to be with you from Brussels. President Obama is in the middle of a press conference right now with the head of the European Union and the head of the Belgian government, and that's part of the EU-American summit here. And he said if Russia thought that the world, meaning the West primarily, would ignore what was happening in Crimea, it miscalculated. But he also conceded yesterday when we were in Amsterdam that Russian forces control Crimea. They're not going to be ejected by force. And the very distinct impression you get, Tom, is that Europe is looking at Crimea, knows it can't change the equation on the ground, and is essentially warning Russia not to escalate this crisis, because if it does, by moving troops deeper into Ukraine or possibly into neighboring Moldova, severe economic sanctions will be launched. The United States, European allies, and Russia will be in a very dramatic economic standoff, and the consequences for the global economy could be pronounced, not to mention what might be happening as far as territorial incursions into Ukraine or other parts of the Russian frontier.
Major, everyone, of course, hoping that Russia will not go further. If it should, what's your sense at the end of these few days in Europe of the degree of unity there? Is Europe really ready to follow through with severe sanctions?
It sounds like it, but you can never be sure, Tom, until it actually happens. And one of the things that's developed in Europe in its relationship with Russia, and I wrote a little bit about this morning in my column at National Journal, which will soon be up on the CBS News website, is that economic ties, both arms trading, energy consumption in Europe, and financial transactions, primarily going through London, have really intensified over the last 8 to 10 years. There is a tremendous amount of integration in all three of those sectors, arms, energy, and financing, with Europe and Russia. Now, the president and the European leaders all talk a very good game about being completely unified, and that they will impose very dire, or what they describe as very dire, economic sanctions on all three of those Russian economic sectors, finance, arms, and energy. But they would prefer not to. Indeed, they would prefer not to. But they know that having essentially conceded Crimea to Russia, though they hope to get it back in some point in the future, if Russia goes beyond that in a territorial ambitious way, they have to respond and not sit back and hope that Russia calculates differently.
Major, what has been the tenor of these meetings? With the Russian presence now in Crimea, the annexation there, is the West back as an opposition to Russia? Are people looking at it that way?
Well, they certainly are. And the White House describes this, as do the European leaders, as a test for the entire international order, national sovereignty, international rule of law, the United Nations, all these things basically hanging in the balance in the post-Cold War structure of those agencies and international law sort of taking supremacy in disagreements among nations and over borders. The participants, the Europeans, the United States, thought they had a rough understanding with Russia, notwithstanding what happened in Georgia in 2008. They certainly didn't anticipate what happened in Crimea, and they are very nervous, extremely nervous about the presence of those Russian forces along the Ukrainian border. And they're also nervous about the adventurism possibly in the Baltic states. And while the president's here in Brussels, after meeting with the EU leadership, he's going to talk to the NATO leaders. And I think you can well expect, Tom, to see more military exercises and a bit more muscularity of NATO forces in those Baltic states and other NATO member nations on the Russian frontier. Worth pointing out, Ukraine is not a member of NATO, neither is Moldova. Article 5 of the NATO Charter says any attack on one NATO member nation is attack on all of them, and there would have to be a collective military response. But, of course, that really means the United States in the lead, because it is by far the most powerful military in the NATO membership.
And, Major, finally, what's been the reception for President Obama here? He's talked a lot about pivoting to Asia. Europe has not been big on his screen. How have the European leaders received the American president? And is American leadership still clearly the prescription here in Europe?
Well, the Europeans know at a time like this, when there's a crisis anywhere on the world stage, particularly with Russia, the United States is central to any discussion and central to any action. So if this had not been a situation overshadowed by the standoff in Crimea, the Europeans would have been a little bit more angry that President Obama had not been here to Brussels, had not sort of paid homage to the European Union and its sense of symmetry and importance in the European economy. But those issues, which were, I would say, roiling a couple of months ago, have died down because the Europeans know they need the United States and they need its collective leadership to deal with Russia. And the European leadership is also extremely pleased that the president will be back here in Brussels for a G7 summit. It was supposed to be the G8 summit, which includes Russia and Sochi, Russia in June. It'll now be here in Brussels in June, putting the president back here at what Europeans and the EU regard as the capital of Europe, Brussels, one more time this year.
Major Garrett, Chief White House Correspondent with CBS News, joining us from Brussels as the president speaks there today. Major, thank you very much for your time.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
President Obama speaking about international order today in Europe. On Monday at a press conference in The Hague in the Netherlands with the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte, President Obama said Russia faces a united front against its actions in Crimea.
Europe and America are united in our support of the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian people. We're united in imposing a cost on Russia for its actions so far. Prime Minister Rutte rightly pointed out yesterday that growing sanctions would bring significant consequences to the Russian economy.
And here is the president today at the press conference in Brussels from his remarks there saying, go further, Russia, and you will face greater isolation.
If Russia continues on its current course, however, the isolation will deepen. Sanctions will increase, and there will be growing consequences for the Russian economy. And this reflects the enduring commitment to the goal that has brought Europe and the United States together for decades, a Europe that is whole and free and at peace.
The president today in Brussels. With us right now from Berlin is John Kornblum, former U.S. ambassador to Germany, 1999 to 2001, former U.S. assistant secretary of state for European affairs, also ambassador at the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. He's now with Knorr LLP, an international law firm in Berlin. John Kornblum, thank you very much for joining us.
I'm very glad to be with you.
Do you see Europe and the United States coming together in an effective way, a way appropriate for 2014 in the face of what's been seen in Crimea and around Ukraine?
I think so far that's been the case. The two sides have had the same interpretation and have come up with a package of sanctions, which is probably appropriate right now. But as you were saying, if things get much worse, it will be expected that much more severe sanctions be levied. And then we'll see. Europe is much more dependent on Russia for its economic well-being than the United States is. We essentially have no trade with Russia. They have an awful lot with Russia. So at some point, it's going to start hurting the Europeans also.
Are we back into some kind of Cold War dynamic? Back in the day, you wrote the famous line, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, that Ronald Reagan delivered. Are we back in dynamics like that or in something else entirely? How do you frame what's going on here?
Well, I don't think we're back to that, because that was a major global confrontation between two ideologically opposed powers with lots of weapons pointed at each other. This is much more a confrontation between groups of countries or one country with other countries who we thought had a partnership working, but we have slowly found out to our dismay that the Russians have quite a different view of partnership than we do. I would liken the relationship more to the one which is developing with China than the Cold War. That is, we're not enemies. We're not close friends either. We have lots of common interests. And there's lots of bumping and grinding, as we used to say, which goes on every day in the relationship.
I think you've said that the U.S. and Europe, in some sense, pushed Russia into this or toward what we've seen in the last couple of weeks.
No, I don't think so. I don't think we pushed them towards it. My own criticism of the Western side is not that we pushed them towards it, but that we have not been paying much attention to it. There has been something developing in Russia for some time. Also, there's been a very bad situation in Ukraine. And we have been turning to other things. Europe have had their crisis with the euro. Our president had to get us out of Afghanistan and out of Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. And so there hasn't really been a very much effort put in to managing the relationship with Russia. And I think that at a minimum that shows that we have missed some negative things that have been going on there.
Do you think Prime Minister President Putin in Russia looks at these meetings in Europe and says, whoa, I'd better put the brakes on here. I've got a united Europe ready to cause me pain, cause my country pain?
Well, no, quite honestly, I think he probably says, well, let them talk. I know in the end they won't do anything anyway. That's part of our disinterest has given him the feeling that he can do more or less whatever he wants with us.
How far do you think he might take that sense of free hand?
I don't know. I hope no further. But it's very hard. Even all the great experts who are writing in the newspapers have not come up with a good explanation of where he thinks he's going. Where we know he's going, and I'm sure you're going to talk about this later, is that he's hurting the economy of his country very badly.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the U.S., Europe, and Russia now, the new standoff, and where it goes. John Kornblum, former U.S. ambassador to Germany, is with us from Berlin today. Been a big player for a long time, or was, in Cold War politics and confrontation from the Reagan era and right on through. We'll hear more voices in just a moment. The president's been talking a lot this week today, big speech, appealing to ideals of democracy and freedom. At The Hague in the Netherlands yesterday, he had a dig at Russia as a regional power, something kind of weak. Here's the president of the United States.
Russia is a regional power that is threatening some of its immediate neighbors, not out of strength, but out of weakness. Ukraine has been a country in which Russia had enormous influence for decades, since the breakup of the Soviet Union. We have considerable influence on our neighbors. We generally don't need to invade them in order to have a strong cooperative relationship with them.
And there was a threat, if Russia goes further, for the West to go further, perhaps much further, with sanctions. The president again.
Should Russia go further, such sectoral sanctions would be appropriate. And that would include areas potentially like energy or finance or arms sales or trade that exists between Europe and the United States and Russia.
John Kornblum, in Berlin, which European nations do you see most aligned with that kind of tough talk on sanctions, and where would the biggest resistance be?
Well, let's turn it around a bit and say, who is dependent? The really dependent countries are the countries of Eastern Europe, Poland, Bulgaria, Romania, the countries which came out of the Warsaw Pact. Their energy supplies are almost totally Russian. Also, Finland is almost totally Russian. Germany, which is Europe's biggest and most important economy, gets about 30% of its energy from Russia. That would hit it hard, but it could deal with it. But Germany also sells several billions worth of industrial goods, chemicals, pharmaceuticals to Russia. So Germany would be hit pretty hard. There's a certain almost sarcastic talk going around right now about a new city called Londongrad. And Londongrad is a place where lots of oligarchs seem to have put all their money, bought football teams and Rolls Royces and things like that.
I.e. the UK, the financial sector, and more there.
That's right. And so you're hearing the British talking a little bit less aggressive than they usually do. The Brits are usually like totally with us. This time they're, I think you see certain nuances in their approach because they're worried about all this money in London. The countries who are very firm tend to be countries like the Scandinavian countries who have no illusions about Russia. They've been under pressure from Russia for a long time. And also people like the Dutch. But in general, I've been quite satisfied and even slightly surprised at the unity so far. And I think that if we have to go another step, you will probably at the beginning see a good deal of unity. If it goes on for a while, it may be less easy. But remember, already the estimate of the World Bank is that $70 billion of capital is flowing out of Russia, that their growth, which was going to be 1.1%, is now going to be a negative growth. The real loser in all of this is Russia and the Russian economy.
$70 billion flowing out of Russia reportedly just in the first quarter of this year, and much of it very recently, that more than the total outflow in all of last year. I want to get a couple of calls and then go to sanctions and where they might really bite Joe. In Marfa, Texas, Joe, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Ambassador John Kornblum.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My family is from eastern Poland.
Mm-hmm.
And if we remember back to 1939, both England and France had treaties to protect Poland in case there was a invasion from Germany, except that when this actually happened, France and England never sent troops there.
What about now, Joe? What do you see coming?
Well, what I see coming is there's going to be a war between the Ukrainians and Russians. And all we're talking here is intellectually about what we hope. I don't believe that the NATO forces are ready to come into Poland and Romania just like they were not in 1939. The Russian people are what's driving this, to protect and to extend their motherland. It isn't Putin. It's the thousand-year history of the Russian people with their mentalities, from the Mongols to the original Russian capital, was in Kiev a thousand
years. Joe, let me get Ambassador Kornblum to respond to that whole perspective. John Kornblum in Berlin, what do you say?
Well, I think that Joe is right when he said that there's a great desire for a sense of Russian pride and nationalism. This is something which goes up and down, partially in accordance with the economic well-being of the people. At the same time, I don't think that there is a groundswell of desire to expand Russia right now. I think it's the other way around, and that is that Mr. Putin, who, as we say, is not in the best political shape, partly because of his economic situation, has been steadily, this just didn't happen 6 months ago, he's been steadily doing this for the past 4 or 5 years, building up this sense of Russia as a great power, building up the imperial trappings of his office. If you ever catch one of his press conferences, it looks like he's in the Groucho Marx movie, you know, with all these big palaces.
Royal,
and everything.
Yeah, golden.
And so he has been using this in order to identify himself with the traditions which Joe talks about.
What about Joe's assertion that there's going to be war between Ukraine and Russia?
I don't think that's the case, most probably because Ukraine's not in any position to fight a war with anybody. They have a military. They have about 400,000 people in their army, but it's poorly equipped, poorly trained, and certainly not combat ready.
So it might come.
I think the problem would be that if Russia ever really decided to move in, they would present us with another fait accompli, and then we would be very much in the corner of what to do about it.
Harry in Chester, Vermont. Harry, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
I would like to say that I think the press has really let us down on this whole business. In addition, our government has engaged in a great deal of lying to the American people. When Berlin failed and collapsed, Gorbachev extended his hand, and above all, he said to H.W. Bush and later Mr. Clinton that he did not want NATO forces expanded to the frontiers of Russia. And by the way, I agree with Joe. The so-called NATO that we're talking about is 85% funded by the American people. And number two, Germany, France, and England have cut their defense budget 25% in the last 2 years.
So, Harry, the lie you're pointing to is you're saying the West led Russia to believe it would not come closer to its borders, but it did.
Exactly. How would you like to feel if the Russians came down to Bahamas?
Harry, let us pick it up right there. John Kornblum, how about it?
Well, I was there at almost every one of these meetings during this era, and I can tell you, and then later, because this assertion has been made a lot, we actually researched it in the State Department, and I can tell you that there never was any sort of commitment or promise not to extend NATO's borders in the direction of Russia. In fact, I myself participated in drafting something called the NATO-Russia Founding Act, which was an effort on our part to open NATO to Russia so that they didn't see NATO as a threat, but rather as a partner who could help them also in their own security systems.
But,
so,
you have said, John, that the West went off on this dramatic program of spreading democracy through NATO and NGOs, and that Russia considered this a violation of that those understandings.
Yeah, they did. But the fact is they had no reason to. And my criticism of the West is not that we broke any promises. We did not lie to the American people. My criticism of us is that we thought that once we had this system going, that it would run on automatic pilot. And if there's anything one learns in foreign policy is that nothing ever runs on automatic pilot. 4 weeks ago, nobody would ever have thought there would have been a Ukraine crisis. Now the whole world has got the Ukraine crisis on its screens. The world is unpredictable, and that's why you need to manage these things. And we have not been managing it very actively over the past 5 or 6 years.
And the G8 now being described as the G7 and Russia on the sidelines. Here was the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov saying yesterday or Monday night that, well, fine, if that's the way Europe wants it, interpreted here by Euronews.
If the West believes that this format has exhausted itself, so be it. We will not be clinging to it. We don't see any tragedy if the G8 doesn't meet. Maybe it's a sort of experiment. We can wait 1 or 1.5 years and see how we survive without it.
The Russian foreign minister, hey, have your experiment. John Kornblum, please stand by in Berlin. With us right now from Washington is Anders Aslund. He's a senior fellow at the Economic Research Group at the Peterson Institute, expert on economic policy in Russia, Ukraine, Eastern Europe. He was an economic advisor to the governments of Russia back in the 90s, Ukraine in the 90s. Anders Aslund, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Do you think Europe is prepared to step up with serious sanctions in a unified manner if Russia goes further?
Yeah, I think very much share Ambassador Kornblum's judgment. On the one hand, Europe is much more economically dependent on Russia, but Europe is also much more threatened by Russia. The U.S. can more easily decide and act faster, but the U.S. doesn't feel it as strongly as Europe do. So I think that we have a very good harmony between the United States and the European Union. And we should not exaggerate Russia's strength. I quite liked President Obama's statement today. And here you have the numbers. The Russian GDP is only 6% of the NATO GDP. And Russian defense expenditure is only 9% of NATO defense expenditure. And even if Europe spends little on defense, it spends 3 times more than Russia on defense. And the Russian arms procurement is massively corrupt. Half of expenditure is considered to be kickbacks. So we should not exaggerate the strength of the Russian military.
But what about Leningrad and all the Russian billions that have floated into the UK and beyond? What about the big German business done with Russia? What about energy dependency on Russia? Isn't Europe vulnerable, even with those numbers, Anders?
Well, the point is that Russia is far more vulnerable. Why do we talk about Leningrad? Well, because Moscow has failed to become a financial center. London is today Russia's financial center. And that means that Russia is extremely financially vulnerable. So you've already touched up on this. The vacillations on the market that we have seen in the first quarter of this year has already cut off 2% of the expected GDP of Russia this year. And the outflow of $70 billion, that's 3.5% of GDP in only one quarter, former Minister of Finance Alexei Kudrin now speaks about a probable outflow of $200 billion from Russia this year, and that is 10% of GDP. So we could expect a similar decline in GDP if only some financial sanctions are being imposed. So I think that's what can really hit Russia hard, and I think that President Putin has massively overplayed his hand economically, financially, and also militarily.
Anders Oslund, John Kornblum, here's the Dutch Prime Minister standing alongside President Obama at a press conference at The Hague yesterday. This is Prime Minister Mark Rutte saying that sanctions, yes, they could hurt, but maybe they could be carefully crafted to diminish the pain for the West.
Obviously, you can never guarantee that the people in Europe, in Canada, in the US would not be hurt. But obviously, we will make sure that we will design these sanctions in such a way that they will have maximum impact on the Russian economy and not on the European, the Canadian, the Japanese, or the American economy.
The Dutch Prime Minister on yesterday. Anders Oslund, is that possible? Can you go with big, serious sanctions for Russia in finance, in arms, in energy, and not hurt Europe, not for that matter, put a stick to the global economy somehow?
Yeah. We should not believe that any sanctions against Russia will have any effect on the global economy. If you take the global economy, Russia's GDP is less than 3%, and its share of global trade is similar. The only area in which Russia is really significant is energy trade. So oil accounts for about half of Russia's exports, and that's what would matter if the oil exports were hit. So that's where we don't want to hit. The gas export is not that important. Europe can actually manage without it, because Europe has already faced Russia cutting off gas exports twice, in 2006 and 2009. So now there's a lot of liquefied natural gas. Coal is enormously cheap now, and often you can use either oil or gas or coal. So Russia's position in gas is not very strong either. It has lost one-third of its sales to Europe in the last 4 years, and it does not have any alternative market, because it only exports gas to Europe through pipelines. So it's Russia that is in a tough place.
We're going to get a perspective from Lilia Shevstova, a Moscow perspective, in just a moment here. But John Kornblum, if all that's correct, if that economic case is correct, does that mean, you know, don't worry, be happy? President Putin wouldn't possibly go further because he would be sitting on an economic mess at home.
Well, that assumes that we think that he is thinking carefully and rationally, and has not overplayed his hand. As Anders just said, I believe he's already much overplayed his hand. You don't know what state of mind he's in. And so, and also, we shouldn't forget that the situation inside Ukraine is not the most stable. So I myself do not believe that there's going to be any more military action by Russia. But the fact is, we're in a very unstable situation. So we have to be very much awake and alert to what's going on.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the U.S., Europe, and Russia now, the new standoff, and where it goes, with former U.S. Ambassador to Germany, John Kornblum, joining us from Berlin, and from Washington, Anders Oslund at the Peterson Institute. The president speaking in Brussels today, talking in big terms about potential sanctions if Russia should go further beyond Crimea, saying he's mindful, the U.S. president, that Western countries may feel some impact from further sanctions if and when they come.
In order for Russia to feel the brunt, the impact of these sanctions, that it will have some impact on the global economy as well as on all the countries that are represented here today. And we're mindful that that's going to be different, not just between the United States and Europe, but also among different countries inside of Europe, some of whom are more dependent, for example, on energy from Russia than others are.
But the U.S. president said if Russia calculated that the West would not hold together, President Obama said today, asserted, that would have been a miscalculation.
If anyone in the Russian leadership thought the world wouldn't care about their actions in Ukraine, or that they could drive a wedge between the European Union and the United States, they clearly miscalculated.
President Obama in Brussels today. John Kornblum, please stand by. Anders Oslin with us right now is Lilia Shevstova. She's chair of the Russian Domestic Policies and Political Institutions Program at the Carnegie Moscow Center. Professor at Moscow's Higher School of Economics joins us today from Washington. Lilia Shevstova, thank you very much for being with us. What do you see unfolding here? Hello, Lilia, are you there? We don't seem to have that connection. I'll try and get it in just a moment here. Anders Oslin, how do you read Moscow? We've heard a little bit from John Kornblum. How do you read Moscow if they're going forward in spite of this potential economic damage?
Well, I think that this is basically an act of desperation by President Putin. He's afraid of a democratic breakthrough in Ukraine and sharp criticism of kleptocrats in Ukraine. And on top of that, his dream project, the Eurasian Union, is stillborn without Ukraine. Now it's only Russia, Kazakhstan and Belarus. And Russia completely subsidizes Belarus. So I think that he sees that he doesn't have much of a future. It's not an immediate crisis for him, but he decided then to opt for a preemptive blow against Ukraine. So I think that he has two interests. One is to take Crimea, that 85% of Russians look upon as their holiday paradise lost. There's a lot of sentiment for Crimea, while it doesn't mean much economically. And the other is that he wants personally to see Ukraine fail, that democracy doesn't work in East Slavic nation. I think that's the point he wants to make. And most of the population normally in any war supports the leaders first. Just remember how it was here, 9/11, massive support for President Bush, which then quickly faded. And what the Russian posters are saying is that this strong support for Putin, which has arisen now, will probably abate after 3 months. That's what happened after the war in Georgia and after the second war in Chechnya in 1999.
Lilia Shevtsova, I think you're joining us now from the Carnegie Moscow Center. Let me put the same question to you. How do you read what is unfolding here in Moscow and the Western response, Lilia?
Well, hi, Tom.
Hello.
Thank you for having me. Well, first of all, if I may, I would like to mention one paradox. Well, the fact that Obama is in Europe, the fact that Europe and America are talking about unity, the fact that, as you've mentioned, Obama is appealing to democracy and freedom, I would say is a major Putin's contribution to the world. This is firstly. And secondly, I would agree with Anders and with Ambassador that what Putin is doing and what Kremlin is doing, of course, well, it simply demonstrates that Russia is in decline, that Russia cannot win, that Russia strategically is lost, you know, in the world history. But at the same time, you know, I would try to mention that Putin's rationality is different from ours. He's working within a totally different paradigm. And apparently he's not that stupid, and he understands the downsides of his actions in Crimea and in Ukraine, the downsides of his confrontation with the West. The problem for Putin is he apparently has understood now that he cannot survive longer in the current model, in the current system that he has in Russia. So he has kicked over the chessboard, not only in the world but in Russia too. And he has drifted towards the war paradigm. This is how he would like to stay in power, to preserve power, because he understands that he cannot survive in a different way. So his rationality is different. He's doing a suicidal thing. It's a suicidal statecraft. And it only demonstrates that apparently the regime is in agony. But this agony can continue for a long time.
You say it's rational, maybe in his terms. If I understood you correctly, you said he's turning to a war paradigm. Why would he do that, and how far might he take that?
Well, he's doing that because apparently he knows Russian history and he understands that sooner or later Russians will take to the street. Because now 56% of Russians, well, they would like him just to get out of the Kremlin in 2018 after he finishes his current presidency. So he has apparently decided to close the country, to start the repressive engine before we have the Russian Maidan.
I thought he had an 80% approval rating lately, Lilia.
That's right, but 80% of approval rating, the Russians are supporting what he is doing in Crimea and Ukraine. The Russians are supporting what he is doing with the West. They would like Russia to continue to deter the immoralized transatlantic nations. But at the same time, the same Russians would not like to have him, you know, in the future. This is a kind of cognitive dissonance that the Russian nation is living in.
If he's turning to a war paradigm, what does that mean? And if he's doing that, does he see real red lines between him and Europe?
Well, he's done it already twice. In 1989, he started the Second Chechen War, and he got 75% of approval rating. In 2008, you know, he went to war with Georgia, 78% of approval rating. So this is his third war, and apparently he does understand that the approval rating that is a result of war mobilization is a very short term. Apparently, he will have to kick, to pinch, and he will have to kick over the chessboard, you know, from now on. I'm not sure that he understands what he's going to do next, but I would say that he still has some resources at his disposal, administrative, well, propaganda, TV. He has such a resource as his belief that the West is not unified. There is also such conviction, apparently, that he has that the West would not dare to inflict pain on itself. And so far, he was right. And even he has scored a small victory. Strategically, he is doomed, Tom. He is doomed, of course. But tactically, he's got a victory now. And President Obama has acknowledged this victory by saying that the sanctions, really tough sanctions, will come should Russia, you know, undertake further actions. So this means that the West has acknowledged the current status quo. And this is Putin's victory.
Paul in Des Moines, Iowa. Paul, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I think the situation in Russia has just gotten in. It's escalated to a point where Putin really doesn't have a way to back off. I think it's a precarious situation just because the only way he's got to go is become more aggressive as he goes, even though it's going to end up hurting him and his country in the long run.
John Kornblum, what about it? Putin can't back down at this point. In some sense, he doesn't have to. The annexation of Crimea may not be recognized by the U.S. and Europe, but he's got it, so he could just stay right where he is, John.
Yeah, he doesn't have to back down right now as such. I think that all three of us talking with you today have, however, made the same point, that he's on a roller coaster ride all the way down and there's not going to be any up to it. And so the real question is, how is he going to try to hang on, and how does the rest of the world, and particularly the United States and Europeans, try and manage this so it doesn't turn into a big crisis? As far as him seizing the Crimea is concerned, it's a sad fact but true that already going back to the 1950s, when a country such as Russia or there are other examples wants to seize some territory, it's very difficult even for the United States to go in and tell them to get out. You just don't do that. I mean, there was things like that in the Balkans, and we shouldn't forget some of the uprisings in Eastern Europe in the 1950s and 60s. So a dictator who has enough strength at home, who wants to do such a thing, can do it and more or less get away with it. We had the situation in Georgia, which is still 20% occupied by the Russians. So this can't be the criterion for who wins or who loses. The winning and losing comes over the longer term. And even though the Russians occupied all these places in Eastern Europe, they ended up collapsing after 40 years. So sometimes one has to have a little bit of patience. But what he's doing is just self-destruction. destructive, as my other colleagues here have said.
Anders Oslund, as Vladimir Putin looks at the images of unity in Europe this week, and he hears the description of much deeper sanctions on finance, on arms, on energy, do you think those look fierce enough or menacing enough to him that they constitute a red line, that because of those, he will go no further? Even in Ukraine, where we're told Russia has a lot of troops on the border.
Well, I think, as Ambassador Kornblum mentioned previously, there is a serious problem of lacking credibility on behalf of particularly the United States in this case. If you compare the G7 declaration from Monday with President Obama's statements during the press conference yesterday, the G7 declaration is much tougher than what President Obama said. It might happen that in a press conference you speak a bit lighter, but these differences will be noticed very firmly in the Kremlin. I'm quite worried that Putin really can't back off. I think that if you have put yourself in this situation, if you have prepared for a more extensive war, as we are seeing so well now in Ukraine, I think it's a great danger to go ahead. So I would like to see more sanctions up front, simply because the Western credibility is so limited. And also, everybody expects the United States to lead. And the European Union is happy to follow the U.S., but it wants to see that the U.S. really leads. And if it doubts the U.S. leadership, then the credibility is really weak.
Lilia Shevtsova, when Moscow, Putin, looks at Europe and the U.S. right now, do you think he sees real unity? And does he see a real threat of deep biting sanctions there or not?
Well, it's difficult to be Putin's shrink, but his actions prove that apparently he doesn't consider these actions on the part of the West, I mean the sanctions, really painful. And I would say, well, I'm trying to get myself into his skin. I wouldn't care about the sanctions because these sanctions will help Putin to so-called nationalize the Russian elite, to mobilize the elite on the basis only of loyalty to him, but not to Leningrad. So for the time being, the sanctions could even mobilize and strengthen his personal rule and also the paradigm of the besieged fortress that he would like to rule.
I guess I'm having trouble picturing what he does with that, or where he would go with that. Okay, let's see. He mobilizes public opinion around a sense of insult in Russia, a sense that he describes the West as being the aggressor here. Where does that go? And Russians are not foolish. Where do they see? How do they see that playing out?
Well, Russians are not foolish. Well, and 56% wishing him to get out sooner or later only is a demonstration of that. I would say that really he cannot backtrack when we are talking about the model of rule, because he understands if he loses a bit, if he opens the window, he's dead, because the Akela wolf is already wounded in the eyes of many. Well, what he could do now, he can play with a variety of roles. At the moment, he's a terminator and even crusader. But tomorrow, I wouldn't reject such an idea that he would offer the West the olive branch, and he would say, let's normalize the situation. And there are a lot of people in Germany and outside of Germany, in France, and including in the United States, who would say, well, let's endorse the status quo. You know, he was insane. He was delusional. Now he's got normal.
John Kornblum, one solution that's been suggested is that what some describe as a democratic uprising in Ukraine might be sort of bottled up here. Federalize the Ukraine, give Moscow influence over some of those eastern Ukraine provinces. Don't take the cleanup and democratization of Ukraine too far. And you could kind of, regularize a status quo that doesn't put a democratic revolution on his southern flank. What about that, John? Will the West agree?
Well, no, I hope not, because that would be bad out of principle, but it would also be simply bad for the economy of Ukraine and for Ukraine in Europe. We shouldn't forget Ukraine is a country of 45 or 46 million people. It's about the size of Texas. And so it's a large and important part of the European scene. It's also a fairly highly developed country, partially because the Russians, the Soviets, put lots of industry there. Its problem has been a truly corrupt political system, political leadership, whichever party, which cared little for the country and more for their own bank accounts. And so I think myself that our role in Ukraine should not be to try to come up with some sort of stuck-together federal system. It already has a federal system, by the way, and Crimea has had a great deal of autonomy already. But rather, we should use our influence that we have there to put on pressure to make sure that they clean up their political system and make it modern and functioning.
Lilia, we just have half a minute here. If this is not a new Cold War, what is it? How do you describe what's going on, Lilia?
Well, this is an attempt of the country that is losing to return the whole world into the past and find the new basis for existence by breaking the rules. So this is not the Cold War. Cold War had rules. This situation is the proposal of Putin to break the rules and to have the right to break them.
Lilia Shevtsova with the Carnegie Moscow Center joining us today from Washington. Lilia, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Anders Oslund at the Peterson Institute. Anders, thank you for your insights today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And John Kornblum in Berlin, former U.S. ambassador to Germany. John, thank you. Ambassador Kornblum, thank you very much for being with us today.
My great pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.